Fryer.
Debussy, Alexander Gurr and Oliver Nussen, all three composers, are celebrating anniversaries this year. Tonight's prom marks the 150th anniversary of Debussy's birth. Sandy Gurr is 80 and Oliver Nussen was 60 in June. Oliver Nussen is here tonight in a dual role. He'll be conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra in his own third symphony after Gurr's imaginary ballet Metamorphosis Dance in the first half of the concert. Then after the interval, the prom culminates in Debussy's complete incidental music for Gabriele D'Annunzio's extravaganza, The Martyrdom of St. Sebastian. It's a rare opportunity to hear it with the New London Chamber Choir, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, and soloists Claire Booth, Polly May, and Claire McColdin. Before that dramatic choral work, the latest composing generation is represented by one of Nussen's protégés, Helen Grime. The BBC Symphony Orchestra will be giving the prom's premiere of her Night Songs, commissioned especially for Nussen's birthday. Helen Grime describes it as a tribute to the man whose music has so inspired her. Alexander Gurr's piece was intended as a ballet sequence for an opera he never completed. It's based on an episode from Homer when Odysseus, heading home after the Trojan Wars, lands on the island of the enchantress Circe. She turns his men into swine, but after she falls in love with him, the sweet-talking Odysseus manages to persuade her to reverse the spell. And by way of compensation, Circe also makes the men taller and younger than before. That concept of physical metamorphosis is given musical expression in this dance through a set of variations, inspired by the finale of Beethoven's final piano sonata, in which the rate of rhythmic change gives the impression of changing speed, even though the underlying pulse remains the same. Gurr's dance runs through 8 variations, punctuated by a repeating refrain. The piece begins swiftly, it slows and then picks up pace again, all initiated by a tap, as if from Circe's magic wand. Alexander Gurr wrote the imaginary ballet in 1973, and it was first performed the following year by the Philharmonia, with Bernard Haitink conducting. That applause greets the leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Anna Coleman, taking a bow before taking her seat and waving Circe's magic wand tonight is Oliver Nussen. He cites Alexander Gurr as one of the new group of composers who were really beginning to make their mark as he was growing up. And here he comes. The members of the orchestra standing as he makes his way to the front of the platform. And he takes his place now to conduct the symphony orchestra in Metamorphosis Dance by Alexander Gurr.
Thank you.
Metamorphosis, dance by Alexander Gurr, using musical reversals to capture the bewitchment and the breaking of a spell cast by Circe in Homer's Odyssey. Oliver Nusson conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra here at the Royal Albert Hall and inviting the leader, Anna Coleman, to stand, and also the principal flute, Daniel Palethorpe. Oliver Nusson putting his baton down during that solo and just listening, so the conductor who very much trusts his players. And he's now making his way to the side of the stage to greet Alexander Gurr, who's here in the hall. Tonight's prom celebrating Alexander Gurr's 80th year. Oliver Nusson ushering him forwards, weaving his way between the first violins to shake hands with the leader and with Oliver Nusson too. Oliver Nusson has been a big promoter of Sandy Gurr's music. Alexander Gurr was the son of Walter Gurr, who studied with Schoenberg. Alexander himself studied with Messiaen, so his style fuses some very disparate musical influences. Well, Oliver Nusson has been called the most precocious British composer since Britten. He wrote his first pieces at the tender age of 6. He went to the Purcell School and at just 15 conducted the London Symphony Orchestra in his first symphony. He regards himself as ridiculously privileged to have had his music performed from such a young age. By the time he was 21, he was already onto his third symphony, which is the piece we're going to hear next. He wrote that almost 40 years ago in 1973. And earlier, I asked Tom Service where this boy wonder sprang from.
Well, I think Ollie's early life was one of the great sort of prodigious events of post-war British music. His father was a double bass player in the London Symphony Orchestra, and Ollie famously, as a young teenager, wrote a symphony that he conducted with the LSO. I think, actually, in retrospect, that sort of great, incredibly early flowering of him as a composer is something that has caused him challenges later, because, in a sense, he was fated as a complete prodigy before he was 20, and he was already a symphonist by his late teens, which, in a way, is probably a difficult thing to deal with. The remarkable thing about that early music when you hear it now is it still sounds exactly as fluent and as vivacious and as full of this sort of unstoppable energy that his music really has had all the way through his composing life. But, I mean, the masterpieces of Oliver Nusson's music, which is pretty well everything he's written, to be honest, because Ollie doesn't give anything to the world unless he thinks of it as doing the job that it needs to do. And because his standards are so high, that pretty well means that everything that's out there is kind of a masterpiece. What he's found is an incredibly distilled way of capturing that life, really. So although the music, something like the Third Symphony, or more recent music like the concertos he's written, a horn concerto, violin concerto, for example, although they might sound on the surface as if they were written incredibly quickly and incredibly fluently, they are the result, they're the prize of years of hard labour at a very private compositional coalface, if you like. But the effect of the music when you hear it is of this sort of unstoppable torrent, really an irresistible torrent of energy and life.
How would you characterise his sound world?
One of the things about Ollie's music is if you know a bit of music by Debussy or Stravinsky or the Russian composers of the late 19th century and early 20th century, what Ollie has done is find a way of capturing the essence of that music and making it sound not like something that could have been written in, 1915 or 1920, something that absolutely can only be written in the 1970s, 1980s, or the early years of the 21st century, but yet has that flavour of magic and colour and communicativeness of that earlier 20th century music. I mean, you hear that very clearly, just in individual chords he writes, like the opening of his opera on Maurice Sendak's book, Where the Wild Things Are. It starts, and immediately, in about 5 seconds, and this really is a kind of absolute magic that only he and other people who've analysed his music really understand, but, within two gestures, two bars, he can create that sense of magic and wonder, and I mean, it's kind of miraculous.
So he uses huge orchestral forces, and yet to create these tiny miniatures. How does he do that?
Well, I think the scale of what he's doing with the orchestra comes from his deep knowledge, love and study of early orchestral repertoire, but also because of his experience as a conductor. I mean, what Oliver Nusson has done for the music of the whole 20th century pretty well any British composer who's alive today, although some of their musical heritage to Oliver Nussen as a teacher or a conductor. It must be for him an incredible act of filtering every time he writes anything down on the paper, because he knows, you know, exactly how to use an orchestra, exactly how to make it work, and exactly how to achieve the greatest possible effect with the smallest possible means. That's also something that he does with his conducting style. I mean, he's unleashing these huge orchestral forces in this whole program tonight, not just in his piece, The Third Symphony, but he'll be doing so with the utmost of economy on the podium as the BBC Symphony Orchestra, you know, obey these tiny flicks of the magician's wand of the baton, and this world of colour is kind of unleashed, you know.
He's really wonderful to watch, isn't he? Because he's a big bear of a man, and yet, as you say, his gestures are tiny.
He's talked about that paradox in a way. The fact he's a big guy. I mean, he's huge, actually, in stature, I mean, in presence as well. And yet, what he does physically to make the orchestra play is extremely economical, and his music too. I mean, all the orchestral pieces, the concertos, the symphonies, none of them last longer than 20 minutes. So although he's conducting pieces on a much bigger scale, you know, his own music is on a much smaller scale in terms of time, but not in terms of musical content or emotional, poetic, expressive substance. I mean, there are so many layers to Ollie's music, and it's so completely densely and richly packed with content. You know, that's not to say that when you hear it for the first time, it's not immediately attractive, because it is. It manages absolutely that trick of being absolutely immediately compelling, any of his pieces. I defy anyone who doesn't know Nussen's music not to hear a few seconds of it and go, well, I want to hear more. And yet it's music that you can go back to and back to and back to and keep discovering new things in it.
Tom Service. Well, Oliver Nussen's Third Symphony was first performed here over 30 years ago. It was regarded as a synthesis of the music he'd composed up to that time. His first symphony, written in the mid-60s, followed a serialist style. 2 years later, he branched into jazz in his concerto for orchestra. He composed choral for large wind band in the early 70s, while simultaneously creating his lyrical second symphony. Combining all these styles in his Third Symphony wasn't an easy task. In fact, Nussen spent 6 years pulling it into shape. One of his fascinations at the time was with the character of Ophelia in Shakespeare's Hamlet, and the music in the first half of the symphony grows increasingly wild, echoing her loss of reason, while the flowing nature of the latter part of the symphony reflects the lovelorn heroine's drowning. Well, the piece, as I say, was given its premiere at the Proms in 1979, reaching its final form with the ink barely dry on the page. Here to conduct it tonight is Oliver Nussen, making his way to the front of the platform and taking a bow before turning to conduct the symphony orchestra in his own Symphony No. 3.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oliver Nussen's Third Symphony. Nussen himself conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra and bringing to their feet immediately the little trio of players at the front, guitar, harp and celeste, played by Nigel Woodhouse, Louise Martin and Elizabeth Burley. Also quick to bring the woodwind to their feet, followed by the brass. The six percussionists, David Hawkins, Christopher Hind, Karen Hutt, Oliver Lowe, Tim Palmer and Ben Fulbrook, and the principal timpanist, John Chimes, and now the strings too. Well, as a big man, he's always been drawn to miniature things, intrigued by precision and fine detail, drawn from a large orchestral palette. Certainly in evidence tonight. Oliver Nussen lives in Snape. For many years, he was artistic director of the Aldborough Festival. This year, the festival celebrated his birthday with a wonderful revival of his opera double bill, Higgledy Piggledy Pop and Where the Wild Things Are, featuring Maurice Sendak's drawings, brilliantly animated in video projection by director Nisha Jones. She screened them in such a way that the singers interacted with the drawings, really bringing the picture books to life. Claire Booth wore a furry wolf suit and sang the part of Max, and she'll be performing in part two of The Prom, taking the title role of St. Sebastian in Debussy's portrayal of his martyrdom. Oliver Nussen back once again, bringing all the players to their feet. And I may have mentioned it was Louise Martin playing harp. In fact, it was Shawnead Williams. Well, the opera double bill was also featured last week at the Tanglewood Festival, where Oliver Nussen was conducting. He's director of the Festival of Contemporary Music at Tanglewood. And he also included music by the young composer Helen Grime. Her tribute to Oliver Nussen, Night Songs, will be beginning the second half of tonight's prom. But first, how did a man described as the Jacobean equivalent of a pub bore become the last person burnt for heresy in England? Journalist Andrew Brown and Dermot McCulloch, Professor of the History of the Church in the University of Oxford, explore the unfortunate case of Edward Whiteman in The Last Heretic.
And on Wednesday last, my Lord of Lichfield sent for me and told me that unless I did recant my opinions, he would burn me at a stake in Burton before All Hallows' Day next. And because he is so earnest to seek my blood without cause and against all law, either of God or man, I do here declare a special token for my better trial, which is this, that great and terrible day, threatened in diverse places in the scriptures to come from God upon the world, shall come to pass and be effected before this All Hallows' Day next.
So wrote Edward Whiteman from the prison in Lichfield. It was the autumn of the year 1611. He had been charged with heresy, a crime which carried the dreadful penalty of death by burning alive while chained to a stake. He would become the last man in Britain to die for that crime in that way. So what changed? What was it that made Edward Whiteman different? Perhaps one factor was the pathos of his claims, obvious in retrospect, and troubling even at the time. The miracle he promised from his jail cell never happened. But neither he nor his persecutors concluded from this that he was just deluded. Instead, the bishop, Richard Neal, and King James I thought Whiteman was so dangerously wrong that death by the public torture of burning was a just punishment. I asked the historian, Dermot McCulloch, what could have led them to this ghastly conclusion?
I think the key to it is to think in terms of cruelty. What I mean by that is that we have very definite ideas of cruelty at the present day. We think that it's cruel to do things to individuals. We feel the pain of another individual human being. Now, previous societies were much more society-minded. It wasn't the individual that mattered to them when they thought about pain and cruelty. It was the pain of society. And they felt that in the case of someone like Edward Whiteman, it was cruel to society to keep him alive. And so the pain which was inflicted on him was much less important than the pain which he had inflicted on society as a whole by being a heretic.
One of the hardest things for us to explain or to understand is why heresy in particular should be seen as so damaging to the feelings of society. To execute someone for treason has a certain logic to it, but to execute them for heresy, how does wrong thought damage the bonds of trust on which society relies?
From the end of the 4th century, there is a thing called Christendom, in which everyone in society is part of the church. And there's only one church, and therefore it only has one belief. And that gets really deeply ingrained in society. In the 4th century to the 17th, you've got 1,300 years of that assumption. So if you start challenging the bundle of beliefs which the church has, you're really challenging society at the same time. If everyone's part of the church, they're part of society.
Known unto all men that I, Edward Whiteman of Burton-upon-Trent, have affirmed myself to be that prophet promised in the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy, and that Elijah in the 4th chapter of Malachi promised to be sent before the great and fearful day of the Lord, and that Comforter in the 16th chapter of John, which should convince the world of sin and righteousness and of judgment, and have delivered a book to the king, and an other that the Lord Archbishop had, besides other odd papers tending to that purpose, containing at least 40 sheets of paper, for which I have been kept close prisoner, with very strict and extreme usages this 22 weeks.
Poor man, he thought he was the prophet Elijah, and in some confused way, also the third person of the Trinity. He thought his own life was proof that the world would soon end. At one time, he had been a devout and respectable cloth merchant. The business failed, we don't know how, and after that he kept a tavern. It came out at his trial that he would carry sheaves of his own prophecies with him and read from them to anyone who showed willing. This, his accusers described as his delight. We can wonder whether the victims were quite so delighted.
He'd have loved blogging, wouldn't he? He's the archetypal blogger. I don't think he's burned because of that, because I think Tudor people, Elizabethan people, Jacobean people, realised nutters when they saw one. Lord Burghley, William Lord Burghley, the great minister of Queen Elizabeth I, kept a file of what we would call green ink letters, people who'd written to him saying that they were the new Messiah and that sort of thing. So they knew that, and I don't think Whiteman died for that. Whiteman died for something else, and that was his views on who Jesus Christ was. And that takes you right into the heart of the Christian faith, and it takes you back to this question of reading the Bible and reading it your own way, which is what Protestants suddenly found terrifying when people like Whiteman read it in a different way.
Then he started to heckle the ministers of the Church of England at their preaching. They presented his case to the bishop, and Whiteman, already in deep trouble but convinced that he was right, sent one of his treatises to King James I. The king reacted as anyone but the poor prophet could have foreseen. He read the treatise and grew angry at its heretic author.
The king told the sheriff o'er city o' Lichfield, greeting. The reverend father in Christ Richard, by divine providence, Bishop of Coventry and Lichfield, has signified until us that he has judicially proceeded in a cause o' heresy against Edward Whiteman o' the parish o' Burton-upon-Trent.
He had the misfortune to come up against a very ideologically determined bishop, a man called Richard Neal, who went on to be one of the great pioneers of high church Anglicanism. I think if he'd come across a different bishop, perhaps a bishop with a greater sense of humour, he might have been saved from the fire.
Concerning the wicked heresies of the Ebionites, Corinthians, Valentinians, Arians, Macedonians, of Simon Magus, of Manes, Manichees, of Photinus and Anabaptists, and moreover, o' other cursed opinions belched by the instinct o' Satan. The aforesaid Edward Whiteman stands adjudged and pronounced an heretic.
James the First was an oddity among kings, and rather dangerous oddity, was that he was a tremendously enthusiastic theologian. He fancied himself as someone who knew about Christianity. After all, he was supreme governor of the Church of England. And so James took an interest in this, and that's a fatal combination. You've got a bishop who's interested, and you've got a king.
Therefore he is decreed as a diseased sheep, to be cut off and cast out of the flock of the Lord, lest our subjects he do infect by his contagion.
King James and Bishop Neal weren't cruel men, nor even by their lights unjust cruel men. What made Whiteman dangerous to society was that in many ways he hadn't moved all that far from orthodoxy. At least he had reached his heretical conclusions by the same method which all respectable people used. He read the Bible and he prayed for guidance to find out what it really meant. We think of the Puritans as strict and rule-bound. They saw themselves as freed. The Spirit spoke to them directly from the Bible. The Spirit prayed through them in public. The Spirit led them into truth and so to freedom. The Spirit, speaking through the Bible, broke the chains of Rome. But the freed slaves of superstition didn't at once form an army for the Lord. They seemed like a crowd, or worse, a rabble, in which every man was lost, since every man thought he alone knew what was the way they all should travel. And so fresh chains were needed which would secure the Reformation. They would do so by securing heretics to the stake.
For instance, if you look at the Bible, it's very difficult to find a doctrine which both Luther and the Pope thought was essential to the Church, and that is baptizing infants. It's just not there. And quite clever Christians said, look, read the Bible. You told us to read the Bible. We can't find infant baptism. Therefore, we must only baptize adults, because that's what the early church did. So that's one issue. Another issue is the whole concept of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Again, you can get these words in the Bible, but you don't, in the Bible, get the relationship. And again, people who read the Bible, having so cleared their minds, would notice that. And they did, right from the 1520s onwards. So Edward Whiteman's quite late on the scene here. He's 80 years in to this process of re-examining what the Bible actually says. And the problem for Protestants is that there is the radical wing beyond them all the time. There is no alternative for Roman Catholics. They know they're orthodox, they're right. Protestants have always got these wrong people who you might say were Protestants. So there's an extra layer of nervousness in Protestants when they think about heresy.
We, therefore, as a zealot of justice and a defender of the Catholic faith, holding that sic an heretic, convict and condemn it according to the laws and customs of this our kingdom of England, and this pair to custom it ought to be burnt with fire.
And James goes on with something very interesting. We, therefore, as a zealot of justice, I like the way he thinks of zealot as a good thing to be, as a zealot of justice and a defender of the Catholic faith. Now, what does he mean by that, Dermot? Because we've been talking about Catholics and Protestants, and here is James, the Protestant monarch, calling himself the defender of the Catholic faith.
Well, that's perfectly simple. The whole point of the Reformation was that Protestants were restoring the true Catholic faith, the true Catholic faith of the first five centuries of the Church. And the whole point of the Reformation is that Roman Catholics are not true Catholics. And so a Protestant monarch is the defender of Catholic faith, on the one side against papists, Roman Catholics, and on the other against any old heretic. So that's exactly what any of the mainstream leaders of the Protestant Reformation would have said about themselves.
Whiteman is asked what he means in some of these papers that he's been reading out to strangers. He writes, for example, "I come as him that hath trodden the winepress alone," says the report of his examination. "He applieth them to himself, though that is a prophecy only proper and personal to Christ. He saith that the selfsame prophecy concerneth him as much as it does Christ." And this is the sort of thing which is unforgivable.
Yes, I mean, he's bigging himself up, and he's also depressing the status of Christ, who he sees as the perfect man. And that is way below the significance of Christ in the Trinity, as it had been accepted by the Church. And he also said that all the creeds of the Church were useless. And that's because they're so late. They're all constructed in the 4th and 5th centuries. So he's making a perfectly valid historical point there.
Yes, but one which is completely incompatible with the understandings of all kinds of mainstream Christianity.
Yeah. Yes. Protestants accepted those creeds just as much as Roman Catholics or Orthodox. That's the common ground of anyone who would want to be considered a mainstream Christian in the 16th or 17th century. Mm. And he'd stepped outside that common ground.
So in one sense, this is an argument about when the early church went wrong. Was it in the 8th century, as Protestants maintained, or in the 3rd century, as Whiteman?
Exactly. Which is the fork in the road? Is it back in the time of the Emperor Constantine, the 4th century, or is it much later when the Bishop of Rome got out of hand? And so that's the big difference between Whiteman and Bishop Neal of Lichfield. They're putting the going off the road in different centuries.
One of the things that struck me thinking about this appalling ceremony, we've been talking of it theologically, but it seems to me to go back to a rather pre-Christian tradition of human sacrifice, in a sense. One sees these stakes all across Europe as the boundary posts of a new orthodoxy.
There's a lot in that, I think. And the problem is that Protestants want to prove that they are more orthodox Christians than Roman Catholics. And they've got a real frisson about this because Catholics have said, "You're heretics. You are betraying the true church." And there is this famous Catholic jibe, "Where was your church before Luther?" And I think that rather haunted Protestants. Where was our church before Luther? And that means that they've got to be as true to the early church as they can be. And you get someone like Whiteman coming along and saying, actually, the early church was wrong. That's the secret. Protestants want to stand on the same foundations as Roman Catholics.
One of the points lurking in what you've been saying is that we think of this now as an expression of the rigidity of religion and of its intolerance of dissent. But actually, at the time, and in terms of the dynamics of the way the people doing it thought, what was the danger was the fluidity, the power, the fact that you couldn't actually specify without a human and political effort what it was that the early church was about.
Yes, I think they're grappling with the great flow of information which they had gained over the last century, the previous century, about the early church. And a lot of it was frankly disconcerting. They didn't know what to do with it. And in the end, of course, it would actually change the boundaries of Protestantism. It would create the modern liberal Protestantism, which we know. And they're just embarking on that long road at the time. And Whiteman, who, you know, is a faintly ludicrous as well as tragic figure, in some ways is the beginning of this process. He's one of the symptoms of looking at the early church and saying, well, it isn't like even Protestant history books say it is.
But it would be a brave, a foolhardy man who doubted the history books after he read of Whiteman's fate. When the fires were set around him, he cried out that he would recant. The crowd ran forward to put out the flames, and he survived, although he was well scorched. He was unchained, but taken back to jail. 2 weeks later, he appeared in court to make a full and proper recantation. He would not. One newsletter said he blasphemed more audaciously than before. And when the king heard, he ordered him burnt again. On the 11th of April, Edward Whiteman was brought once more to the stake. Once more, when he felt the flames, he screamed that he would recant, that he had never meant it. This time there was no mercy. The sheriff told him he should cozen him no more and commanded faggots to be set to him, where roaring he was burnt to ashes. The bishop, writing 30 years later, could only recall that Whiteman had died blaspheming.
If I were being an Oxford examiner on this, I would say that Edward Whiteman was a borderline case. And he's the borderline between being a heretic and being a loony. And the trouble was that in this case, his examiners put him on the heretic side rather than on the loony side. And this, I think, may be why he is the last one, that it's such a stretched case, it's such an untidy case, that a lot of influential people quietly thought to themselves, I don't think we want to see that again. They didn't say so, because it wasn't respectable to say so, but that the sort of wind had gone out of the sails of the persecuting impulse with Whiteman's burning.
But there was one more, deeper reason for this change. We glimpse it in the reaction of the crowd when Whiteman first recanted. They rushed forward then to save him, and they put the fire out even though some were burnt themselves. Common humanity, or Christian love, was for a moment stronger than the flames of orthodoxy, and would grow stronger still. Burning for heresy was finally abolished in England in 1677.
The Last Heretic was presented by Andrew Brown and produced by Louise Yeoman in Edinburgh. Readings were by Simon Tate, and Whiteman's prophecies were used by the permission of the archives of Lincoln Cathedral. Welcome back to tonight's prom, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nusson. And the final work tonight commemorates another man who suffered for his faith, The Martyrdom of St. Sebastian, a piece by Debussy that was deemed so shocking the Pope threatened any Catholic who saw it with excommunication. This will be its first prom's outing, and as the stage is still being reset after the interval, it gives us the chance to find out more about the central character. St. Sebastian has been an icon of religious art since the mid-15th century. I went to the National Gallery in the company of curator Caroline Campbell to seek out one of the most famous depictions of the saint. Well, we're here in the Sainsbury Wing, and we're surrounded by lots of magnificent gilt frames with all sorts of paintings of saints and Madonnas. And then right at the end of the gallery is this huge altarpiece.
Yes, this enormous altarpiece of St. Sebastian. This painting was intended for an oratory in one of the key churches in Florence, this Annunciata, where there was an image of the miracle-working Virgin kept that was supposed to have been painted in the 13th century by divine intervention.
So I'd like to ask you first of all, who was St. Sebastian? He's not someone we're terribly familiar with.
Well, he was a 3rd century Christian martyr. He was possibly born in Narbonne, possibly in Milan. The sources are not quite clear about this fact. But he was definitely the chief guard of the Emperor Diocletian, who was one of the persecutors of the early Christians before Constantine came on the scene. And Sebastian is somebody who converted to Christianity. Diocletian says that he wants Sebastian to be shot like a porcupine with arrows coming out of him like the spikes. But that doesn't kill him. He's rescued by a lovely woman, St. Irene, and he's nursed back to health. And then he is killed properly. He's dispatched with a sword. He doesn't really become a saint of incredible popularity, really, until about the 14th and the 15th centuries.
And why do you think Sebastian was such a popular figure for artists?
I think for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that he was somebody who people wanted to have painted in altarpieces, which of course were religious devotional works. And there was a great plague, the Black Death, in the 14th century in Europe, and people became increasingly devoted to saints who were thought to save you from the pestilence. And Sebastian was one of these, because his body had been unblemished by the sort of arrows who were thrown at him, and he had survived that, though not subsequent punishments. So he often is associated with the plague and is thought to be a plague saint.
Who's it by and why did they choose this subject?
Well, this painting is by a pair of brothers, Antonio and Piero del Pollaiolo, and they were two of the greatest Florentine artists of the mid-late 15th century. They weren't just painters, they were also active very much as sculptors. And I think you can see this in the painting because we see St. Sebastian hoisted up on a tree trunk, made to look very much as if he's like Christ. And he's surrounded by all these archers, and their bodies are displayed consciously so that we can see the human body in a 360-degree fashion, really.
And they're very different, aren't they? Because they're dressed in tunics which are belted, hoiked up so that we can see their legs and their musculature of their arms and legs. But Sebastian in the middle is almost completely naked, apart from this little tiny loincloth, and then the arrows are hanging out of him in a rather unpleasant way.
He is, but he doesn't look terribly distressed by the fashion, which is also something I find very strange about this painting. And an early 16th century source by Giorgio Vasari, the first art historian, who of course was a great historian of Florentine painting, says that the figure of St. Sebastian was based on somebody who was the most beautiful boy of his generation, Ludovico Capponi.
And do you think it was just an excuse because of the way that he was killed to have this almost naked male figure in the centre of your supposedly devotional painting?
Well, that's a very interesting point. And historians have recently been working on the question of sort of same-sex relationships in 15th century Florence. And it was a city at the time that was notorious for its sodomy, or for the number of people who were engaged in same-sex relationships, or at least it was thought to be more accepted there than it was in other places. And this may have been some significance to the fact that we see this naked man in this Florentine altarpiece. And I think this is particularly apposite for Pollaiolo's painting from mid-15th century Florence. Sebastian begins to be confused with the iconography of Apollo, or of sort of earlier classical ideals of great male beauty. And I think in Florence, where they were really beginning to explore the relationship between the ancient Roman past and their civilization in a new way, and called themselves often the New Rome, this was particularly significant.
And he's being pierced by arrows shot by these archers at very close range. And they're using very different bows, aren't they? They're not all using the same type of bow.
No, some of them are using crossbows, which would have been really the height of military sophistication at this time. And others are using much more ornamental type bows, possibly meant to evoke more of a sort of Roman bow, because this is a scene that is set in ancient Christian Rome. And the Pollaiolo brothers are consciously trying to show this in their painting. There's a collapsed archway at the top left-hand side. So again, like images of early Christ, it's meant to evoke the superiority of Christianity to pagan civilization.
I was talking to Caroline Campbell from the National Gallery. Well, the first Proms performance of Debussy's The Martyrdom of St. Sebastian follows a brand new work, a BBC commission by the young composer Helen Grime. It's called Night Songs, and I asked Helen where the title came from.
Well, the title actually came from an artwork by Joseph Cornell. He was an American artist. He died in the 70s, I think. And he specialised in something called assemblage. So he made these boxes, and they're quite small, and they're usually themed, so some of them themed around birds and some of them are themed around night, and this one, night songs. It just immediately captured my imagination, and it's very much a sort of self-contained miniature world. And it sort of sparked off an idea for me. You know, I knew that I was writing a 5-minute piece and I wanted to encapsulate a specific sort of atmosphere, miniature world.
And how would you characterise night sound?
Well, there are sort of dreamlike, trance-like passages within the piece, but as the piece gets further through, these dreamlike episodes become more frantic, and there's a lot of underlying tension and sort of sometimes quite sinister sounds coming out from within the orchestra.
Helen Grime, who studied just across the road here at the Royal College of Music. Oliver Nussen has conducted her work at the Proms before. In 2009, the BBC Symphony Orchestra performed her piece called Virga, and Boulez went on to conduct its French premiere with the Orchestre de Paris the following year. Like Nussen, she's a composer who prefers not to rush. 2 or 3 pieces a year, Helen says, is as much as I can manage. Well, she has plenty of commissions pending from the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Centre and the Halle, where she's recently been appointed associate composer. And she has a wonderful down-to-earth attitude. One reason she gave up playing the oboe, she said, was all that fiddling with reeds. It brings on neurosis. Well, having said that, she's written an oboe concerto, and there's also a prominent role for oboes in the piece that we're about to hear. And the man to conduct that piece is Oliver Nussen. Coming on to conduct this birthday tribute to him, composed by Helen Grime. It's called Night Songs. Thank you.
fell off. I think we did all right, but I'd just like to play it again to make sure.
The joys of being 60.
The BBC Symphony Orchestra with that double world premiere, or perhaps a world premiere with the fastest instant repeat known in history of that BBC commission, Night Songs by Helen Grime. The piece, a tribute to the man conducting it tonight, Oliver Nusson, a keen champion of her music, so keen he wanted to play it all over again. Oliver Nusson greeting Helen Grime with a kiss on each cheek and enthusiastically joining in the applause. Well, Helen misses out on an anniversary by just a year. She was born in 1981, so she turned 30 last year. She studied oboe with John Anderson and composition with Julian Anderson and Edwin Roxburgh at the Royal College of Music. And she was there earlier on this evening talking to Helen's service, to Tom's service in one of our Proms composer portraits. That will be broadcast tonight at 10 o'clock, and it's available via Listen Again for the next 7 days. Just follow the links from the Radio 3 homepage at bbc.co.uk/Radio 3. Well, Oliver Nusson says he's crazy about art, Goya in particular, he's been getting into recently, appreciating him in the same sort of way that he appreciates Beethoven. Earlier, we heard about the attraction for painters of the figure of St. Sebastian, the 3rd century soldier who was persecuted for his Christian faith and shot with arrows on the orders of the Emperor Diocletian. It wasn't a painting, but a dancer who inspired the Italian writer Gabriele D'Annunzio to put together a multimedia extravaganza based on the martyrdom of St. Sebastian, inspired by medieval mystery plays. In 1910, keen to escape his creditors in Italy, D'Annunzio fled to Paris and was entranced by Ida Rubinstein's performances with the Ballet Russe. "Here," he said, "are the legs of St. Sebastian for which I've been searching for years." Ida Rubinstein not only had the legs and the androgynous beauty needed for the part, she also had the money to commission works for herself. And although various composers turned down D'Annunzio's offer to compose music for the piece, it was finally accepted by a penny-pinched Debussy. It was planned to unfold on a grand scale, incorporating 3 dances for Ida Rubinstein, 4 symphonic movements, choruses, and parts for a smaller number of voices. Debussy wrote just over an hour's music in all. Fokine was engaged as choreographer and Leon Bakst as designer. It can't be said it was a triumph. The whole production ran for over 5 hours in all, and audiences were bewildered by the mismatch between D'Annunzio's exuberant poetry and Debussy's subtly shifting harmonies. Well, the original production included a role for narrator, which we won't be hearing this evening. Instead, the piece starts with the first of 5 mansions or acts set in the Court of the Lilies. After the prelude, 2 Christian brothers, Marcus and Marcellianus, are bound to a pillar and about to be tortured, yet can still sing of Christ's love. Sebastian is awaiting his own punishment and asks God for a sign. An arrow he fires into the air miraculously doesn't return to earth, and the brothers are freed from their bonds. Sebastian performs a second miracle, dancing on hot coals which turn to lilies, and the brothers sing a hymn of praise. In the second mansion, the magic chamber, introduced by a dark and brooding solo on the contrabassoon, Sebastian heals the virgin Erigone, and she becomes a Christian. In the third, the Council of False Gods, Sebastian is put on trial in front of the Emperor Diocletian. The parallels with Christ that are so apparent in painters' portrayals of the saint are very much in evidence here. And then Diocletian is so swayed by Sebastian's words, he offers to make him a god, so rather missing the point. Sebastian angrily rejects the idea, and the result, he's condemned to death. A chorus of women, that applause you've just heard, greeting the arrival of the women on stage, weep for the death of the young Adonis. Sebastian himself bewails his suffering as the world is red with his torture. And then the 4th and 5th mansions run without a break. As a chorus of Syrians mourn, Sebastian is granted a vision of paradise. A chorus of apostles invites him to become one of their number. Angels urge him to scale the heights of music, and the soul of Saint Sebastian ascends to heaven. The culmination of the work is a chorus of all the saints praising the Lord with dulcimer and organ, timbrels and cymbals, flute and zither. Alleluia. While massed forces are required to render Debussy's music, the New London Chamber Choir have teamed up with the BBC National Chorus of Wales, and we're about to be joined by soloists Claire Booth, Polly May, and Claire McAlden. They're joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Polly May and Claire McAlden, both making their proms debuts this evening. They'll be standing in the centre of the chorus on the top risers above the orchestra, the two of them directly below the bust of Sir Henry Wood. And here comes Claire Booth, who'll be standing at the front, just to the left of the conductor. And that conductor, Oliver Nusson, following her to the front of the platform and applauding on his hand with his baton as she takes her bow. So this is The Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian by Claude Debussy.
Thank you. Thank you.
A chorus of all the saints praising the Lord with every instrument they can think of at the end of The Martyrdom of St. Sebastian by Debussy, who called on most of those instruments and more for that massive work. Music composed to accompany a stage performance conceived by the Italian poet and writer Gabriele D'Annunzio. Oliver Nusson giving the music its first complete airing at the Proms, conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the New London Chamber Choir, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, and soloists soprano Claire Booth and mezzos Holly May and Claire McAlden. Ollie Nusson kissing Claire Booth's hand, Claire Booth having to stand up on tiptoe. She's tiny compared with Oliver Nusson. Incidentally, the painting of the Martyrdom of St. Sebastian by the Paolo Aiolo brothers that I was discussing earlier with Caroline Campbell at the National Gallery is available for you to see on the Radio 3 website, together with a longer version of our conversation. That's at bbc.co.uk/Radio 3. And here comes Claire Booth back onto the platform, followed by the chorus master, Adrian Partington, who's picking out the semi-chorus, Les Coryphées, drawn from the BBC National Chorus of Wales, which has a policy of using young singers, these eight singers just 19 or 20 years old, Vanessa Bowers, Amy Campbell, Sarah Chu, Frances Gregory, Lucy Hughes, Sean Newman, Philippa Scammell, and Eleanor Stowe. And Adrian Partington now bringing all the singers to their feet, and Ollie Nusson joining in by bringing the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra into a standing position. The leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra tonight, Anna Coleman. Well, the Proms this year marking Debussy's 150th anniversary as well as Nusson's 60th birthday. And they'll be having a total immersion in Oliver Nusson's music in November. That's the Symphony Orchestra. Listen out for more details of that. There'll be more Debussy at the Proms, his ballet Jeu, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Simon Rattle, in the first of their two concerts on Thursday, the 30th of August. And the Symphony Orchestra will be back for their 10th Prom on Wednesday evening, the 29th. Martin Brabins with Elgar's First Symphony, and joined by the London Philharmonic Choir and the BBC Symphony Chorus for Howell's Hymnus Paradisi. But after our own vision of paradise this evening, that's it from the Royal Albert Hall. I'll hand you back to Jonathan Swain.
Louise, thank you very much. Louise Fryer there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as well as the iPlayer for listening online over the next 7 days, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom broadcast here on BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms, on Thursday the 6th of September at 2 p.m. And if that St. Sebastian music has you wanting more Debussy from the Proms, there's his Sonata for Flute, Viola and Harp in Monday's Lunchtime Chamber Prom. That's at 1 o'clock on Monday. And as Louise was just saying, this Thursday evening, Debussy's Ballet Jeu is one of the pieces in the first of two Proms this year with Sir Simon Rattle and his Berlin Philharmonic. Debussy and Jeu very concerned about the sound of his score. In a letter to his friend André Caplet, he said, "I have to find an orchestration without feet for this music. I'm thinking of that orchestral colouring which seems lit from behind, and of which there are so many marvellous effects in Wagner's Parsifal." And you can hear Parsifal's Act 3 Prelude and the luminous Good Friday music in tomorrow night's Prom. Daniele Gatti conducts the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, and violinist Frank-Peter Zimmermann joins them for the Berg Violin Concerto. That's here on Radio 3 at 7:30 tomorrow night. Well, if you came to tonight's Prom before the Debussy, you would have heard Night Songs by Helen Grime, twice in fact, once with Oliver Nusson's glasses on, once without. And Helen Grime was also the focus of a Proms composer portrait earlier this evening, for which she was joined by presenter Tom Service.
Well, Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music in London, just over the road from the Royal Albert Hall, for this Proms composer portrait of the music of Helen Grime. Now, we're going to hear three chamber pieces by Helen, all of them played by students here at the Royal College of Music. Shadow Play for soprano, saxophone and piano, To See the Summer Sky for violin and viola, and we start, though, with 10 miniatures for solo piano. Now, look, Helen, I'm delighted you're on stage with me here. Look, you composed this piece when you were only in your late 20s. I mean, in your late 20s. I say that given that you were only 30 last year. I mean, all the music we're going to be hearing this evening is pretty recent. But look, 10 miniatures, but it's a single movement that plays for about 5.5 minutes. How did you compress all these 10 ideas, 10 little pieces, in a way, into one single movement?
Well, I wanted to write a piece where I was able to concentrate on tiny little miniatures, but I'm always thinking about the larger form. So there's a central idea, which is really quite simple, that you hear at the beginning. And my idea was that I wanted to see how I might take quite a simple idea and turn that material into quite unusual things. So often it might become something very different to the original idea. So really I wanted to set myself miniature challenges. So I'm doing very different things in these 10 movements, but also thinking about how I can create a piece which works as one movement.
And there's a big kind of expressive range you're using here, even in 5 minutes, the way that something melancholic, as you call it, goes into something exuberant. I mean, there's a big expressive range that connects these little miniatures as well.
Exactly, yeah. So I was thinking about contrasts, different speeds, very different atmospheres. But the musical material I'm using is not, that there's not very much of it, actually. It's just that I'm trying to push it as far as I possibly can. It's a bit like a sort of a compositional study for me, really.
Perfect. Look, it's a perfect place to start this selection of three of your pieces. So please welcome on stage here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, Mayuko Yamashita, to play 10 miniatures for solo piano by Helen Grime.
Thank you.
Mayuka Yamashita played Helen Grimes' 10 miniatures for solo piano. Now, look, Helen, something about that piece that makes it quite individual in the context of your whole output and the other pieces we're going to hear tonight, which have, the other two pieces have got titles, To See the Summer Sky and Shadow Play. I mean, most of your pieces have some kind of a character or descriptive title. So 10 miniatures doesn't, and other pieces rarely do in Europe. Why is that? Is there always a kind of extra musical or inspiration or something you're going for before, that's the impulse before you start a piece?
There often is an extra musical starting point. And actually, with the 10 miniatures, there was as well. It's just that I decided not to give it a descriptive title. Sometimes I like to keep the starting point as something which is just for me, and the piece moves away from it.
But it suggests that quite a lot of, I mean, what you're doing in that first bit of composition or the first bit of inspiration is about an idea that comes from something else, whether it's a thunderstorm, I don't know, a picture, a piece of literature, that you then want to translate into music somehow. Is it a translation of an idea or is it something more complicated?
Yeah, it's more that sometimes something from a line or a word in a poem or something about a picture that I'm looking at will focus my ideas in a certain way. And I'm just looking for that one sort of bit of excitement, that one sort of thing to get me going, really. And then I can move away from that. But I find that also it helps me to think of new ways of expressing things by looking at other art forms particularly.
What kind of thing are you thinking of? I mean, specific examples and pieces you've written. I mean, there's a fantastic orchestral piece called Virga, which is it's such a fantastic idea. It's based on this meteorological thing, which is rain that evaporates before it gets to the ground, which creates this wonderful effect of light, which is a kind of epiphany that inspired the piece. I mean, other examples of that kind of thing?
So, I mean, it's sort of, for that, in that instance, it was translated into a sort of musical gesture. The idea of having extremes of register, for example, or falling gestures in the music. So it can be something like that. It might be a rhythmic idea, for example. One of the movements in the piano piece, actually, which is very still, but it's the two hands are quite separate, and they're sort of marking out different tempos. And you know, it's certain ideas like that which can suggest musical things to me, I find very useful. It helps me to try and say new things. I mean, obviously there's a language there, and I want to be consistent, but I also want to try and do something different in each piece.
Do you remember a time when you weren't thinking compositionally? I mean, you are a very good oboe player. You played the oboe in the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland. I mean, has music always been that sort of thing for you? Or do you remember a time when you didn't have that kind of compositional impulse?
I'm not sure. Yes, I think when I was much younger, when I was a small child, I was very interested in drawing, and that was really the thing that I would do all the time. But it always went along with music. I listened to a lot of music that came through the family. My grandparents were both music teachers. My mother's a music teacher as well. So, there was always a lot of music in the house. And, of course, I played piano and then later recorder and oboe. So it was just something that felt quite natural. And I was very, very lucky to go to a music school in Edinburgh where all students were offered composition lessons. And it was something that, you know, it was felt that everyone should try doing.
What was that like, that first experience of composing? I mean, was it difficult, or was it that moment, a kind of Damascene moment where you think, this is what I should do?
I think it's not difficult when you first sort of start composing. If only it was so easy now. But it felt something that felt very personal and special. And of course, what I was doing wasn't particularly personal or original. It would be very unusual if it was at that young stage. But it felt like something precious to me.
That's a very precious thing, isn't it? I mean, that feeling that what you're doing. Because, I mean, presumably, if it didn't feel that it was something that you had to do for yourself,
you wouldn't devote
a life to it. No. So, looking back on that period now, were you influenced though by other composers, things that inspired you, that kicked you off?
Well, if I look back, I actually found some early compositions quite recently, And it's very, they're very much influenced by French music, and particularly Debussy. I can really see that in the piano writing. And I listened to a lot of Debussy and Ravel when I was younger, and they were still composers who are hugely important for me.
What about living composers? Do you remember an encounter with a living composer that made you think, okay, composers aren't just people who write the music who aren't alive anymore, but are people around us?
Yeah, I mean, I went to a prom when I was a lot younger, and Tippett was there, and that was exciting. It's always amazing to see the person who's created this thing, and not just to think of something that, you know, the composers are all dead. So it's, yeah.
Were you attracted to, you know, the avant-garde music when you were growing up?
Yes, I was. I listened to a lot of music, and I think that expanded certainly when I came to college as well, and I started listening to much, much more. And around about that time, I heard Nussen's music, so some late teenage years, and I was immediately struck by this incredibly beautiful, precise sound world. And it just seemed to me when I heard his music for the first time that I couldn't, it just, all the notes were the right notes, and you couldn't have changed any of them. It's so, so beautiful and perfect.
Wonderful then that he's conducting, of course, the world premiere of Night Songs, your orchestral piece. Look, To See the Summer Sky, what's the story behind the right notes? I've heard it in rehearsal, I promise these are the right notes, into To See the Summer Sky. What's the inspiration for this piece?
Well, actually, speaking of having an extra musical stimulus, this has a poetic title, and it's from Emily Dickinson, but the title actually came after the piece, so it wasn't the starting point. Sometimes the instruments themselves are just enough, and in this case, the violin and the viola, it's such a wonderful combination. You can make so many different sounds on string instruments, and yeah, that was really, I just went wild with it, I think, with this piece. It's a lot of fun.
Four movements, again, very sharply contrasted. As you'll hear, the fourth movement is this fantastic motu perpetuo that has all kinds of surprises in it, especially after the three movements we've heard before then. I mean, do you know when you start a piece like this, about 12, 13 minutes long, where you're going to end up when you start writing?
Well, I did in the case of this piece. This piece was interesting because the last movement I wrote first, and I actually wrote it when I was studying in Tanglewood. In America.
In Boston, near Boston.
Yeah, so the funny thing about this was one of the exercises we had to do when we were away was write a piece a day. So that last movement I wrote in a day.
You wrote that whole last movement in one day?
Yeah, I mean, it's very short. It's probably like 45 seconds, but it's very fast. There's a lot of notes in it, yeah. but then that was a good starting point then for the rest of the piece, and often starting from a different point, whether it be the end or from somewhere in the middle, can help them with generating the rest of the piece, I think.
Well, let's hear it now. So please welcome on stage here at the Royal College of Music to play Helen Grimes' To See the Summer Sky, violinist Joseph Duval and viola player Natasha Silva. Helen Grimes to see the summer sky here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, the Royal College of Music. Joseph Duval on violin and Natasha Silver on viola. Helen, so that title then came after you'd written the whole piece. Why? What's the connection then? But did you feel between that line from Emily Dickinson and that piece?
There was just something about the piece which I felt was always sort of trying to fly away. You know, it's always sort of fluttering around the extremes. It's very, very high, and it's sometimes quite ethereal, and it just sort of struck a chord with me. There's something birds and sky and, yeah.
Look, you mentioned that composing, now you've reached the venerable age of 31, is much, you know, is harder for you now than it was 15 years ago or so. I mean, why? I mean, you've been doing more of it. You're writing orchestral pieces, Proms commissions, pieces for the Halle, where you're associate composer now, pieces in America and Sweden, everywhere else. I mean, shouldn't it get easier?
But I think actually the more you know, the harder it gets. And it gets to a certain stage where you've done certain things, and you either sort of replicate those or you find new ways of saying things, and that's very difficult. And also, when you first start composing, everything that you do, you're discovering something new, and it's not quite like that when you've been doing it for a longer time, I think.
Is it also because you don't want to repeat yourself, that each piece is its own world in a way? Every piece you write like a separate, completely separate world?
I hope so. It has to feel like that for me, certainly. I mean, I think, that maybe everything doesn't have to be completely different, but you set yourself these challenges, and I think often composers make life quite difficult for themselves because of this. But I think there's a lot in the music. I mean, in that piece, it's a very detailed piece, and there are a lot of notes in it, but actually the notes really count. It's never really just textural, and it takes a long time to get them all there. And that's the same then with the larger ensemble pieces and the orchestral pieces. There's always I'm thinking about different layers, and it just seems to take me a long time. For some composers, they're quicker.
So what are the things then? what are the things you've discovered so far, and what are the things you want your music to discover in the future?
I'm not really sure. I'm always trying to push myself further. I'm never completely happy with a piece because I feel, I haven't achieved that ideal. And I know there's an ideal that I'm sort of looking for somewhere, and I'm sort of always trying to get to that. And I suppose that's the same with all artists, always trying to reach this sort of level of more perfection.
Well, what is
that's
that?
That's what it's for me.
I mean, is that an expressive thing, a technical thing,
musical thing? It's an expressive thing. But in order to achieve that expressive thing, you need extreme sort of technical command. So I suppose I'm always trying to develop that, because I can hear if there are little kinks where the timing's not quite right, the pacing, an idea doesn't have as much impact as I would have liked.
But that might be the performers. Even if it's true that, you know, Daniel Harding and Pierre Boulez have conducted your music, there are still going to be problems with their performances, just as there are with any performance. I mean, there are things that be different. I mean, that might be their fault, not yours.
I suppose my ideal is to write a piece that, even if it's played really badly, will still sound great. I don't know if that's possible, but
it's an interesting philosophical point. Is it where the boundaries are? You still want the players to play the right notes, yeah? Or something.
Yes, like I always want the players to play the right notes, just because you know, that's something in my music which is very important, is a pitch content. So yeah, I'm always sort of listening out for the right notes.
Because the outside, you know, as a listener, there are things that connect the music of yours that I've heard, which is it does feel as if every note has a reason to be there, and it feels also that there's a sense of line going through your pieces. Mm-hmm. I mean, even all the music we've heard so far has got tremendous expressive variety, and yet there seems to be, you know, something, some line, some even lyricism actually connecting the beginning to the end of the piece.
Yeah, that's really important to me. I mean, in a sense, I'm sort of trying to guide the listener, and not in an obvious way, but I think there is always a strong line. And I'm also looking for some sense of inevitability in the music. I want for it, you know, a climax to feel like it's in the right, for it to feel inevitable, and then to be able to surprise people also. But it's very directional, the music. It's always going towards something.
Hello, Luke, just before we hear Amy Green and Jennifer Hughes play Shadow Play, your piece for a soprano, sax and piano, I mean, look, who are you writing this music for? I mean, it is essentially, like for all composers, every piece you write a kind of outward manifestation of this internal dialogue and striving for perfection, or is it also got, you know, bigger circles of people who you're writing for?
No, I try only to write for myself, but I think it's difficult to know because, you know, obviously influenced by other people. And yes, I do want people to like my music. But I mean, I hope that if I like something, that some other people will like it too. So I am really writing what I want to hear, and I hope that some other people like hearing it too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, Shadow Play, this soprano, sax, and piano piece. Can you, again, there's another very redolent title there.
Yeah, I mean, what I was thinking about with this piece is that the soprano saxophone can be, it's a very strong instrument, but I was really thinking about the relationship between the piano and the saxophone. And at the beginning, the piano plays quite resonant, loud chords, and I wanted the saxophone to come out of this as if it's sort of always coming out of the shadows, moving in and out of the shadows, in and out of focus. So that was the idea really behind the beginning of the piece.
As opposed to, because it would be easy to have a saxophone and piano piece where the piano is kind of always in the saxophone shadow, given how loud an instrument it is.
Exactly, yeah. So I sort of wanted to play with that a little bit, and they become equal in the last movement. But the second movement is for solo saxophone. But again, it's in three movements, but I think it really, it's in one movement, really, but in three sections.
Helen, thank you. Well, let's hear it now. Helen Grimes, Shadow Play, Amy Green, soprano saxophone, and Jennifer Hughes on piano.
Thank you.
That was Shadow Play by Helen Grime, played by Amy Green on soprano saxophone and Jennifer Hughes on piano. And it ends that Proms composer portrait of Helen Grime, given earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music in London. The performers were all Royal College students, and the presenter was Tom Service. Well, my apologies after tonight's live Prom. We're running a little late. But next on Radio 3, Here and Now, presented by Ivan Hewitt.
Hello. Well, with the Olympics behind us and the Paralympics about to start next week, in today's programme we salute the vast cultural jamboree that is London 2012 with the last two of New Music 20x12. These were 20 new pieces, commissioned to be 12 minutes in length, all designed to mark the Olympic year and to reflect the game's general theme of faster, higher, stronger. We'll find out how Shima Mukherjee and Richard Corston took these ambitions on board in their new works tonight. And the latest instalment of the Here and Now 50 looks at one of those cult pieces of the 1970s which just keeps coming round in new guises. Gavin Bryars' Jesus Blood Never Failed Me Yet. So, on to the first of those 20x12 commissions. This is one which really broke the mould of the typical new music premiere. It was commissioned from Shima Mukherjee, a sitar player and composer who's one of the UK's best-known fusion musicians. She studied with reverend masters of Hindustani classical music, including Nikhil Banerjee, but in her own work she collaborates with musicians across every musical divide, from electronica to folk. Her 20x12 piece is called Bending the Dark, and it was created in collaboration with the multicultural performing group The Imagined Village. Shima Mukherjee.
The Imagined Village is a collective, I would say. It includes English traditional musicians, Indian traditional musicians, and quite a lot of electronica. When I applied for the 2012 Olympics Commission for the Cultural Olympiad, I thought to myself, well, what do I write? How do I write it? You know, the band itself is such an interesting group and there's a lot of fun in it as well. There's a lot of comedy there. And then I thought, well, I mean, my background is through Indian classical music, and in Indian classical music, each note has a meaning. For example, your tonic, it means infinity. The second note is sorrow. Third is peace. Fourth is romance. And the sixth note, which is dha, is heroic. And I thought, heroic, that's a good point to start. And so originally the piece was actually called Bending the Dha, as opposed to Bending the Dark. And it was actually a typo that occurred with me and Simon Emerson. He put Bending the Dark in there, and I thought, well, actually, there's also an opposite character to each note, and for the tar, the opposite character is disgust. So I thought probably best to keep it as Bending the Dark. And actually, it has quite a lot of meaning for a lot of people. The way I wrote the piece of music, I actually had the end part, and then myself and Martin Carthy, we used to noodle a little tune called The Cuckoo's Nest. I won't tell you what that means, it's quite rude, but we used to noodle this little tune, and I used to really like it. It was a very positive, happy tune. And I thought to myself, it would be quite nice to incorporate that tune within the 12-minute piece. So it's the actual piece is based around the kind of heroic centre of what I feel is the Olympics. And The Cuckoo's Nest, which are two little positive pieces. And I have kept some sections which are improvised. It's within a constraints, because that's what we do. And it was actually remarkably easy to put it together. I was worried. I have to say, I was quite worried about how I would show people, for example, the way we work, the way we break up timing, 7.5 beats. How do you break that up? I break it up differently from the way a Western musician would do it, but then it's 15. But I wouldn't kind of expect the listeners to actually even notice that it's something quite complicated, because fundamentally I work with something that feels comfortable. If it didn't feel comfortable, I wouldn't have written it or put it together in that way.
Sa sa mi ka ka sa sa mi sa sa ma ni ni sa sa mi.